Hi, everybody, and welcome to Ask Margot. I'm Margot de Coatsworth, and I will be your host today, answering questions that people are stuck on, the things in life that need a solution or just need a new perspective. I'm a writer and a clinical hypnotherapist, and my mission in life is to change people's thinking about what's possible, their intrinsic worth, and especially around the power of their mind to dictate the health of their body, and then to show them how to use those same transformational principles to change the things in their lives that they don't want into the things that they choose. Wouldn't it be great if we felt we were living by our own choices and not by default, accepting things we don't want and that don't make our lives better and don't serve us? I read something the other day that I found very pointed, and I was going to say amusing, but that's really not the right word. Ironic, maybe, is the word. It's about what we're prepared to believe. We see evidence of something maybe once that we've not seen before, and we don't know how it happened, so we call it an anomaly. We just stick with what we already believe, and we push that oddity off to the side, as though it was some kind of glitch in the fabric of reality. For example, when somebody gets better instantly, what do they call it? Spontaneous remission, because no one's prepared to say they're actually better or healed. Why aren't we pouncing on the thing that was fixed and turning ourselves inside out to discover what made that happen? I was reading the other day a book from a chap who talks about permanent healing. His name is Daniel Condron. He gave this example. He said, if you go to a skeptical scientist and you say, here's a pig who can speak English, so that's seemingly impossible, the scientist says, but that's just one pig. Bring me another pig who speaks English. Then maybe I'll entertain the possibility that pigs can speak English. Do you see how silly this is? If one person has achieved something, then it is achievable. And isn't it our duty as scientists or just as human beings who need to know why things work the way they do and what's possible for us to look into it? We need to focus on the anomalies, the spontaneous healings, the things that happen one time that have never happened before that we know of. Otherwise, we just accept the status quo, which is like saying we already know all there is to know. And that's ludicrous. We must investigate so we can understand how we can do things better and live more successfully. It's our duty to say, oh, look at this thing that's happened. Let's find out what made it happen instead of pretending it didn't. If someone got better, then let's find out why that happened. What were they thinking? What were they doing? What changed? What were the factors that came into play to create that change to make that seemingly impossible thing possible? The next time somebody says to you, well, that's not possible, you say to them, you don't know that. You only know that you haven't seen it or that it hasn't happened yet. That's my little soapbox for the day. But it's dumb of us to accept stuff that doesn't make sense and isn't helping us. I know some scientists who are also what I call God people, who are open to a greater understanding and a bigger acceptance of what path to follow to find the answers we seek. Imagine if you could connect those two things, God and science, and leave any attitude at the door. There are people who have done that. Einstein did it. He held a clear, strong belief, and he tried to match that with his scientific understanding. Imagine if you could get those two things to dance together instead of fighting each other. Oh, God versus science, people say. How silly. God is science. Nature is God. I don't know if I told you this little story before, but I was watching something the other day, and there was a big fire out of control in the hills. Two people were watching and talking to each other about it. The older one said, "Who will put that fire out?" And the younger one said, "God will." And the older one looked skeptical and said, "You mean nature?" And the younger one, without missing a beat, said, "Yes, that's what I said." I thought that was very cool. And food for thought. Now, food for thought, this is actually runs into our next question, which is about the no work party. We've had a bit of a party season recently, and I'm always on a quest for the perfect, perhaps mythical, no work party. It sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I think I may have just experienced it. In talking about planning for parties, Dana asked me what I thought the best style of party was that would be the least effort for the host. This question is perfectly timed. Let me tell you about a friend of mine who is a very accomplished hostess. I went to this party and she had her house all beautifully set up, flowers, candles, all the tableware that we needed. And that's a big job in itself. So, of course, if you don't count that part of it, maybe your house is like that all the time, Dana. My friend told me she was going, as she called it, pig hunting. And she meant that she was going to search for a ham. So she brought her ham home and she invited a friend who happened to be a chef to come and stay. And he did a fabulous job of glazing this ham. It looked really beautiful. Then she invites her guests. They all brought a plate. But these were beautiful dishes of things, salads with fresh cherries and fresh peaches and little tarts with garlicky baba ganoush and a fabulous potato salad. There may have been about 40 people altogether. Some came and went. And somebody bought the most delicious Basque cheesecake that I've ever seen. I took a tray of petit fours, so everything came together beautifully, cherries and cheeses and all kinds of deliciousness. It was seriously good food. And all she did was go pig hunting and put an ice bucket out for people to put their wine in, which they also brought. The plates were paper, which is not really my thing, but they worked because she had all her silverware polished and sparkling. No one had to do dishes. So there's my suggestion, Dana. The thing is with these ideas is that you don't want people to just go to the supermarket and buy a packet of some little sad thing and slap it on the table. I think there might have been just two things like that. If you want to be more strategic, you must ask people to bring the dishes you know they make really well. Nobody minds contributing. I think they like to do it. They'd rather that than see you stuck in a kitchen. It's a potluck, and we don't have to eat conventionally. So if you have a ham and a few other bits, maybe that's enough. Good music, good company. What more do you need? If you don't want to outsource the work, then here's another idea I've seen work quite well. And that is that you have a main dish like ham or salmon or chicken, something like that. And then another dish of little cooked potatoes, which we all love here. Put them in a big bowl. Use your big dishes for this. And I don't know, they just have a kind of flourish when you do things en masse like that. Then make a salad, a spectacular salad with fantastic things in it, substantial, with a great dressing and maybe, I don't know, nuts or seeds or something, pomegranate, something over the top that adds a bit of crunch. Things on a big scale like that have impact. That's really easy. Three dishes. I once did an antipasto party where I thought, wouldn't it be good if everybody just brought one element? They might bring some sliced salami or cherry tomatoes. They might bring grilled vegetables. Just one thing. And as they arrived, you could just have a big platter out and tip their ingredient onto it. So you have this lovely array of goodies that make your antipasto offering. It's quite hard to get people not to embellish them. You know, if you say, please bring some cherry tomatoes, they will think, oh, that's too simple and I'll just make a composed salad. That's not what you want, of course. So you have to spell things out, tell people exactly what you need and what you're planning. And they can just bring olives or some cured meat. You could do the same thing with a salad where people bring an individual component. You just pour it all together, put it all together, pour over a dressing, and it's done. Ta-da! After Christmas this last year, on Boxing Day, I invited my larger family, greater family, to get together and called it a leftover lunch because I didn't want anybody to do work. I just wanted them to bring what they had and pull our resources together. We ended up with salmon and desserts and all kinds of goodies that were left over from several households' endeavours over Christmas. And then nobody felt faint because they had too much food to deal with or too much work to do. We got together without any stress, and it was actually really fabulous. I also think having a party straight after a party is a good idea because your house is ready and it's set up for it. All your gear is out and you've made enough food to go a little bit further. So you can invite a different batch of people. People love to be invited into someone's house for dinner. It's exciting, and not everybody does it anymore. I know that people can get quite nervous about it. They think, oh, I don't really know how to entertain. There are so many components to think of: setting up, hosting, drinks, getting the food right, and especially the timing. The thing to do is to delegate. So if you're just a single person doing this, you must find a man who's not going to just turn into a guest, but who's onto it. And not all men are like that. Someone who's going to pour drinks diligently and not just pour his own and then relax. This man could be a woman, of course. Decide ahead of time if you want people to help with dishes or not. I personally prefer to do it myself later and just be in the party mode at the time. If you like to have things done as you go along, that actually does make a difference to the end of event workload and the state of your kitchen. I tend to let family help, but ban friends from my kitchen. Just to give you one last idea, Donna, which was a party I went to recently. So interesting, nothing like I'd been to before. It was on a rooftop in a big city, and it was called a shrimp boil. Sounds sort of awful, but for here, we would call it prawns. It was a giant pot with something called bay seasoning, which you can buy in the States or order, or you can make it. And this pot is full of potatoes, corn on the cob, bay seasoning, shrimp, and a smoked sausage like kielbasa or andouille or even chorizo. So all of this is cooked into a sort of lovely kind of soupy mass and then tipped out onto paper, and people help themselves. Sort of outrageous, unexpected and fun, and the real definition of a casual one-pot event. So I hope there are some ideas in there for you, Dana. It's fun to entertain, and even better if you can enjoy it. Our next question today is about how to find the fantastic father within. It's from Daniel, and he says, I'm about to become a father, and I just don't know that I've got what it takes to do that. The devotion, the absolute change that there will be in my life, I don't know that I can deliver. It worries me and I feel inadequate. I'm not sure I'm up to the task. What advice do you have for me? I want to feel strong and sure that I will make a great dad. I did do some research on this because there are a lot of changes that happen when you become a father. Actually, almost in every imaginable way, Daniel. Biological, psychological, and behavioural. Change that helps men transition from focusing primarily on themselves or their partner to embracing the responsibilities of parenthood. Here's some of the science behind this transformation. Men experience significant hormonal changes during their transition to fatherhood, which influences their behavior and emotional engagement. Testosterone levels often drop in expectant and new fathers. This means less aggression and a greater focus on caregiving and bonding. Oxytocin surges during physical contact with baby, holding, feeding, or playing, promoting nurturing behavior, and it strengthens the emotional connection with your baby. Prolactin, which is mostly associated with lactation in mothers, also rises in fathers. It's kind of like a mirror thing that happens between the parents in a way. This hormone enhances sensitivity to the baby's needs and supports caregiving instincts. Isn't that amazing? Cortisol, a stress hormone, initially increases during the early stages of fatherhood to heighten vigilance. No sleeping on the job, boys. over time, it stabilizes and fathers adapt to their new role, therefore reducing stress and fostering confidence. Fatherhood induces actual physical changes in the brain. These are responsible for emotional regulation, empathy, and problem solving. Now, I know you see universal implementation of some of these things, but this is what we are wired for. These changes help fathers become more attuned to their children's needs and emotions. Men define themselves not just as individuals or partners, but as caregivers and protectors. And this new identity fosters a sense of purpose and responsibility. I know a new father who, when his baby was born, said to me, "It's like being in love." And you know what that does to us. "Baby, your wish is my command." Many fathers feel a deep motivation to protect and provide for their children's future, pass on values, knowledge, and traditions. The thing I find most interesting, Daniel, is that changes happen in our brains, actual physical change. Hormones that help us do a great job as parents are released, and we do find we have the capacity and resources to be great parents. We just need to step into it. You'll be a great father. The fact that you're asking this question just proves how much you already care and want to do a good job. I have no doubt you'll do just that, Daniel. Congratulations. I do recommend reading and researching on the subject. Knowledge gives you such a great head start. Our next question today is about constant chatter about ill health. I spoke to Dave the other day, and his question was about the people around him who are constantly talking about their ailments. He said it just seems such a heavy-duty topic, and it's always so negative. He wanted to know how to handle it. Well, actually, he said, "How do I handle it?" Sometimes I've been tempted to say in a gathering of friends that we can have 5 minutes to present each other with our health concerns, and then the subject is banned. Not that I've actually ever done that, but I do like the idea. I find to ask people questions that are still about them, but steer them away from what's wrong with their health is best. Pick up a cue from the conversation and guide things that way. You can even say, "May I interject?" and then ask them what they think about something related to what they've said, but not about their endless health issues. I have an English friend, she's elderly, and no matter what the state of her health is in that moment, if you ask her how she is, she always says, "Very well, thank you." Once I saw an English skit on the subject where the chap said that even if you are off to the gallows the next day, or what should I say, even if you're at death's door, you must always, when asked how you are, say, "Very well, thank you." As you hobble off down the street, the person you said it to will be very impressed. Seriously, though, we must speak about what we want and not what we don't. We must choose our identifiers. I am is your identifier. You are the only one who gets to choose what comes after that. I am very well, thank you. I am getting better and better every day. I am seeing myself in perfect health. Our power lies in our minds, and that is totally under our management. We choose what we focus on, what we believe, what we think, what we speak about, what we tell others is so. Who hears that? We hear it. Our subconscious mind hears it. Our genie, that's our subconscious, hears it and follows our instructions. Other people hear it and they take it on board. The universe hears it and works on our behalf. If you pull back and look at this question objectively, which option, to speak about illness or to speak about wellness, which feels better? You may feel that something that is wrong with your body makes you feel powerless, but you have an amazing, powerful mind and you can choose to employ that power and that right to use it for your benefit, or you can shrug your shoulders and take no responsibility for directing your health. You can be passive and accept what you don't want. One thing I have to say is sometimes healing takes time. Whatever your choices are for getting better, keep doing them. Do what your doctor says, but manage your beliefs, your thoughts, your words. And when you attempt to talk negatively about your health, zip it. Don't allow yourself to. As Winston Churchill said, never, ever, ever give up. When someone gives you something, what do you say? You say, thank you. So act as though your health has been given to you. Act as though your request has been granted and say, thank you. Thank you, universe. Thank you, body. Thank you, God, for my perfect health. Act as though it's done. Everything that shows up in a tangible reality begins first with what I call the unseen. Thoughts become things. Tangible things begin as thoughts in someone's mind. So, Dave, turn those conversations in a different direction. Or maybe just say, let's not talk about what's wrong with us today. It makes me feel sort of hopeless. They'll get that. Can we talk about something more upbeat? Or just skip straight to the how can we be of help to you? That shifts people along to a more positive take on how should we fix the problem. In the end, of course, Dave, you are only responsible for you. Try what I've suggested in being more proactive about using your mind to manage your health, and maybe you can be a shining example to those people. You could start by saying to them what you plan to do to achieve and maintain your health, and never let it go, never give up. I never mean to be trite about health. I know that when it's out of whack, it ruins our lives. I try to keep things a bit light so I don't sound too bossy. I have little things that go wrong with my body, but I speak to my body and I tell it what to do and how I see it. And I don't give up. I say things like, my body regenerates and renews as I sleep. I look at any area of difficulty and I say, you are in perfect balance. And as my children would say, in mint condition. I'm flexible, I'm pain-free, things like that. If you've never spoken to your body before, if it sounds odd, too bad, try it. You will be surprised. You're the boss of you. Just tell it what you want. Dave, you could try sharing that idea with your friends who have ailments. That'll certainly give them something to say that will take them slightly off their own topic. Thank you for your question. Our final question today is what to do if a man isn't stepping up. Delilah has a question because she's in love with a man and she can't get him to do what she calls front up. They have a sort of relationship and he has told her he loves her, so she's fixed on that. She said to me, I can't help it. I always find it so easy to excuse him and find reasons why he doesn't step up. He's so lovely, she says, and he says and does wonderful things, gives me things, compliments me. It's such a challenge in these matters of the heart to find the happy ever after we're looking for. It's hard to resist what we feel, to not make allowances, and in the end, what amounts to excuses. I don't know that I can just say, stop it, because it can be so powerful that we can feel powerless to resist it. My best and probably only advice is to sit it out until you are strong enough to say to yourself, if he wanted to, he would, dot, dot, dot. Then to him, if you wanted me, you would. This works the other way as well, of course, gentlemen. If the girl wanted you, she'd make sure you knew. And if she didn't or couldn't get to that point, then you don't want her. My personal philosophy is never to want anybody who doesn't want me. Just don't. Always remember that you are worth more, and you just need to find the person who sees that. Well, that's a short one. And that's us for today. Send any questions you have into us at Coast Access Radio, admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz. or to me under the contact tab at margounlimited.com. We love to hear from you, and it's Margot with a T. I spoke to someone recently who wanted to know whether something she was working on was true or not. And I sought a response for her from the Word, the universe, on her behalf. I'm sharing this message with you today because it applies to every one of us. So our message from the Word. Here we go. You are right that you can hear from me through any means that exists. I am. And that is the most powerful statement in the universe. You are seekers, and that is after my own heart. You must also expect and determine that you will apply your God-given clarity to every single thing that presents itself in life. You are the essence of me, so you must see with my eyes and understand with my mind. That is your answer. Discern. You will always need to do this. So the answer is, the truth lies everywhere. It is good and right to seek it, but of no consequence to you if you do not apply your discernment and see it with clarity. Thank you for your fine company today. Keep your truth antennae up. I'm Margot de Coatsworth, and this is Ask Margot.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.